The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today the topic, as we said last week, is Asia, specifically China. And, you know, bringing this up, you and your dad actually took investment groups both in 1991 and in 1992 to China, which was, you know, 5 to 6 years before the handover of Hong Kong and actually about 8 years before the Asian contagion. Why has China been so much on your mind over the last almost two decades?
China and Asia both have captured the world's imagination going back to the days of Marco Polo. I mean, this is an area where not only has there been a massive amount of population density, you know, in the last two, three decades, but also going back for not only hundreds, but even thousands of years.
Well, so, if you think about it, I mean, even the discovery of America was based on an Asian trying to open up the Asian routes from the other side. So there's been a lot of money thrown at trying to make Asia the next great thing.
And so with curiosity, we certainly have explored on the ground, whether it's South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and, you know, we've spent a lot of time in Asia as a family. In fact, my father spends 6 months out of the year there now, both with business opportunities in mind, but also with the different orphanages he's involved with there. Right. More recently, 2002, Mark Faber wrote a book called Tomorrow's Gold, Asia's Age of Discovery. And it was a fascinating look ahead, and it was right on time in terms of the last significant boom in Asia from a growth perspective, from an equities perspective. And sure enough, during the massive credit expansion here in the United States and the massive consumer binge, this last period of consumer binging here in the United States and in Europe, we saw a huge explosion in growth in manufacturing and exports there in Asia, but China specifically.
Well, that brings up a good point, too, because they actually call it the China miracle. I mean, the last 30 years, especially the last three decades, have just been phenomenal as far as growth. There's actually never been any country in history that's grown at the speed that China has as far as GDP. Now, what was that based on, Dave?
Well, it was based primarily on U.S. and European consumption. Mm-hmm. Because, again, what they've brought to the table is inexpensive manufacturing capacity. And so as corporations globally have looked to increase market share and increase profitability, what they've done is lowered their cost structure by moving their manufacturing plants to the cheapest place possible. And, you know, that was very controversial in the 80s and early 90s because you essentially were employing slave labor to improve your earnings.
Right.
Now, it's not quite slave labor today, but it is still inexpensive labor, and there's been a lot of reforms over the last 10 to 15 years, particularly in China. But it's been of interest to us for a long time. We've had many conversations here on air with Stephen Roach. We're looking forward to a conversation with Martin Jakes. And, of course, we've had Mark Faber on the line as well. And so the question remains, is Asia something that should be on our radar screen? Should it be something that we're excited about? And to be honest, we have just as much trepidation and concern as we do interest, intrigue, and excitement.
Well, that's an interesting thing to say because there are some prominent investment advisors out there right now that are saying that Asia is a machine of growth on its own. You know, we call it the decoupling thesis, where China actually is creating its own growth. But in reality, David, I mean, when we interviewed Stephen Roach, he was talking about 75% of their growth basically came from either U.S. or Western consumption or fixed-rate bonds that they were buying.
That's right. Between exports and fixed investments, that grew from 1979 at 34% of GDP. Up until 2007, it represents 75% of GDP. And there were a number of things that came from that conversation. I would encourage any of our listeners who haven't perused that interview to go back to June 9th and by all means indulge, because that was one of the critical points, is there is a transition which is required of China, and it has not been made. So this contingent future success is dependent on a very significant if.
Well, David, the timeliness of this conversation is that China and Japan are both at a significant juncture right now, are they not?
Kevin, it's really not just a story of Chinese ascendancy, because we have had the Chinese economy become the second largest economy in the world, surpassing Japan, which has held that slot since the late 1960s.
That just happened this year.
That's correct. And the issue is not just Chinese growth, but it's also after the property bust and then the lost decade in Japan, they have yet to recover and are still in significant decline. So again, it's not just a question of Chinese ascendancy to the number two spot, but also that the Japanese have taken a significant step back.
Well, David, we talk about China taking over as the second largest economy in the world, but the big if is, can they do it on their own, or is it still just fueled by Western consumption?
And I think you have a strong indication of that, Kevin, in what they're doing with their currency. They certainly have postured over the last 2 to 3 quarters that they will be revaluing their currency higher. But when push comes to shove, what do they do if the world is now becoming a more competitive place in terms of industrial manufacturing and distribution of goods? Lo and behold, this week they are devaluing their currency and doing so to the extent that they've wiped out all of the appreciation you've seen in that currency up to this point in the year.
So in other words, they were saying they were casting a vote of somewhat confidence or cooperation by letting their currency be higher, but now they're saying, Now, things are getting rough in this economy. We're going to lower our currency so that our manufacturing is more competitive than yours.
In word, what they were doing is getting out of the limelight at the last G20 meeting. They didn't want to be the primary topic of discussion. And so they weren't, because they made, in word only, the indication that
they were placating them.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a very minute appreciation in the currency. But what they've done is signal that they do indeed depend on their manufacturing base. And they are not in a place where they can depend on internally generated growth at this juncture.
Well, David, we've spoken about in the past how in the 1930s, the United States represented the main manufacturing base. Anything that they said, whether it was protectionist measures or whatever, it affected the rest of the world. Now we have a number of players. How has that changed with China being in the loop?
Well, like the 1930s period, where in the U.S., as a result of the Smoot-Hawley protective tariffs, tariffs and trade barriers that totaled 21,000 different protective measures, we now are not the only significant manufacturers. And it is just as important to watch what the Chinese do in regards to trade barriers and tariffs. It's not just the U.S. that could throw the world into a greater depression.
So it's trade barriers, tariffs, and the power that they can use with currency manipulation like we just saw this week.
Very possibly.
So with this economic slowdown here in the West, I mean, we could see some real tension in China. I mean, China is a very, very old country. It's one of the points that Martin Jacks makes in his book. It's almost a civilization unto itself. But as far as the tensions within that country, I mean, how many dynasties have there been, and how many overthrows of those dynasties or replacements?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, 36 different dynasties, and, you know, they change usually with some degree of violence. It's not sort of a democratic handover from one party to the next or one family to the next. It is a tremendous amount of social discontent and basically a civil war, if you will. We're used to and know what one civil war looks like here in the United States. Imagine a 2,500-year history in which you have 36 civil wars, and you might understand why the Politburo is so concerned about social cohesion and social control.
Yeah, it just happens to be communism right now, the dynasty of communism.
Right, yeah. But they have not opened the political forums. They have only opened the economy. Back to that big if, the if which has to take place for them to be launched as a success story beyond a success story on the backs of U.S. credit. And we'll get into that and unpack that a little bit here in a minute. They have to make the transition from being an externally dependent, again, going back to export growth, externally dependent to becoming an internally independent GDP growth generator. And at this point, they have not done that. They have led Asia in many regards, in terms of growth and innovation and everything else, but they're still predominantly dependent on the West for their growth and for their revenue stream.
Well, you know, David, some of the listeners might be asking, why do we continue to go back to China? But there seems to be a strange mindset right now that we're seeing since the financial crisis came up in 2008. And that is, you're starting to hear the words failure of capitalism. And they're using China as an example of a, you know, an extreme example of the success of a communist or a controlled economy, a command economy, when in reality, that may be a complete misread of what's gone on over the last three decades.
I think it's a complete misread, and I'll tell you why for two reasons. First, in contrast to the United States, and that's also an opinion complemented by the idea that China and Asia will be the engine of growth leading us out of this global recession, which is simply preposterous. If you look at what the U.S. consumer represents in the world marketplace, we are 4.5% of the world's population and a $10 trillion consumer. When you combine not just China, but India as well, two of the most populous countries in the world, together representing 40% of world population, combined, their consumption contribution to GDP on an annual basis is $2.5 trillion.
That is a phenomenal, overwhelming statistic.
So
now, we are over-consumers, but they're under-consumers for the engine that they need, or for the fuel for the engine.
Well, they don't have any capacity to expand that, except with some fundamental changes in their culture. But we're talking 40 times the population and one-fourth our GDP, or global GDP contribution, in terms of consumption. So the engine of growth, maybe the little engine that could, with sheer grit and determination, could carry the animals over the hill and to the village. But listen, this is not what we're talking about.
Well, you know, Hernando de Soto said the mystery of capital really comes from ownership, being able to own and operate with your own capital. And in a communist system, that's just not there right now. So is consumption dependent, partially, on being able to take out a loan based on what you have in collateral in your own name?
Well, that certainly is helpful. And in the conversation with Stephen Roach, he pointed out three different things: that there is an excess of savings because there is a broad-based social insecurity.
Right.
There are no social safety nets like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. There is no pension schemes. So you are solely dependent for your retirement or for being able to take care of your parents in old age.
Or else you starve.
Exactly. So the savings rate in 2000 was 27.5%, and by 2008 had risen to 37.5%.
So better than a third of what they make, they're saving, not spending.
And while we may, by contrast, say, well, that's laudable, what we have here in the United States is a whole group of people who are committed to their own personal well-being and sort of lifestyle largesse, where we go out and spend everything that we make. They don't, because they don't have Social Security waiting for them, or a company pension waiting for them, or the equivalent of a 401k.
Or really, even the stability of a regime that's been there for more than 50 years.
Yeah. So that would be one of the critical points. There's got to be structural political change that accommodates this safety net and allows for them to consume rather than save. And I don't want anyone to confuse that with us sort of transitioning and becoming Keynesians ourselves,
right,
thinking that, you know, just spend, and tomorrow will be a better day. But the point is, for China in particular, and this is in contrast with the United States, we need to transition back towards saving more,
right,
and they need to find some middle ground. So both of us need to move to sort of towards the middle, a return to savings on our part, and just an initiation of spending on theirs, at least below the 27 to 37% that they're currently saving.
Well, David, when we interviewed Friedman, one of the things that he brought out was that China may look very prosperous with a small portion of their population, but actually there's extreme poverty, or it's decreasing, but it's still poverty in the rural sides of the country, which is the majority of the populace.
Well, that's exactly right. There is a huge lag in rural income. 800 million impoverished Chinese, and this is the point, you don't have an enfranchised population. You have a select few on the coasts, centered on 10 coastal cities, where there has been a tremendous amount of opportunity.
Right.
But for the vast majority of Chinese, it is still critical at the poverty level. And thus, something like price inflation in food can be disastrous to the state, because you've got 800 million people who are at the margins of either making it or starving. And that's the point, is that social stability in China hangs by a very thin thread, because they have not pursued requisite or needed land reforms and tax rebates for people people in the interior, in the agrarian or agricultural sectors.
So it's almost multiple countries, because at the same time, you've got a housing bubble that's been expanding due to debt in China and a trillion-dollar bailout package that's been thrown at things. Yet you still have people who really don't even know how to buy their next bowl of rice.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that has to transition is a significant new source of job creation. I mean, up to this point, it's been manufacturing for the sake of exports.
For the consumption of the West.
Exactly. Yeah. So you are feeding a monster outside of your own borders, and that is very interesting. But this is what has to change significantly. There has to be a service sector that develops. There has to be, again, that internal consumption dynamic. And to assume, as many have, this goes back to the point of criticism, that China has not, contrary to the stated numbers, has not pulled through this with flying colors.
Mm-hmm.
The government put into the system $1 trillion in the context of the crisis. And guess what that did? I mean, that would be like our government on a scale of things, introducing $4 to $5 trillion of stimulus overnight. And it's been argued that they could do that another 2 or 3 times, both with their foreign currency reserves and with just the wherewithal of their monetary authorities, because their balance sheet is actually in a healthier position, a less leveraged balance sheet to date than our own. So they have more leeway in terms of creating that money.
Yeah, but you know, the central bank monetization or these bailout funds, this is a new game for China. I mean, this is a new triple decade of growth, and now they're throwing stimulus packages to try to keep this lack of consumption from the West from affecting them. But David, that's not real productivity. We've talked about this a number of times. All you're doing is you're just throwing newly printed money at a problem to delay the outcome or the consequence.
When that money runs out, that is a very mournful day.
Yeah.
And so the question then is, do we do a second round of stimulus, a third round of stimulus? There are limits as to the number of stimuli you can put into the system, given a limitation in resources. We're experimenting with that here in the United States. What they're experiencing is a significant demand shock. In other words, they have the capacity for huge manufacturing, and it's going underutilized as demand for those products has declined both here in the United States and in Europe. And it's not that we're their only trade partners, it's just that we're the most significant and largest trade partners. I mean, this is the danger of any business having 80% of their revenues come from 20% of their client base.
Mm-hmm.
It makes for a very dangerous scenario when any one of those component parts of the 20 is impaired. And that is exactly what we're experiencing here. Is the middle class, those who consume and spend virtually all of their income, guess what they're not doing right now?
Right.
They're not buying extra trinkets. They've gone from a negative savings rate to now a 6% savings rate. Again, we're moving towards the middle, as we should be, but the cost is in China and in Asia.
That's where the trillion-dollar stimulus package in China had to come in, because we really have backed away, and they have not felt the full pain of that contraction here in the West. Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Well, David, I know there are people out there right now that are feeling and thinking that China ultimately will rule the world, that it's almost an inevitable event. And what are your thoughts on that, given what we've just spoken about?
Well, we've been reading a book in recent weeks, and in coming weeks, we'll be interviewing the author, Martin Jakes, When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order.
That's a pretty strong statement.
Well, and this is the issue. I'm intrigued by the topic. I don't know that it's highly probable, but I certainly want to understand the argument as best we can. What is the evidence that points to a significant regional domination by China and even a world domination by China?
And there are always two sides to a story, or many sides to the story. And, you know, the China phenomenon could continue in some way that we haven't really recognized. One of the things that Martin Jakes brings out is the decline of the Western consumption based on its collapse in debt may just give China the stage to rise in power as we decline in power. Now, he spends 531 pages counting the index on making his point. So, obviously, he had something to say, and it was an interesting book. But as far as the decline of the West and the rise of China based on that, wouldn't they have to replace, like we've said before, the consumption element within their own borders?
Well, I think this is something that's very important, just a distinction that needs to be made. the decline of the West is at a very marginal level at this point. Mm-hmm. And the rise of China is also at a very marginal level relative to the U.S. I mean, again, going back to those GDP contribution numbers and looking at our population versus theirs, they are basically a third world impoverished country with the exception of 10 to 12 cities along the coast, which are very, very impressive. And that's mainly where your tourists and investors will go and spend time. But on the whole and on a per capita basis, it is still an impoverished country.
Well, and the renminbi is really not even an internationally convertible currency at this point. Now, that could change.
And in fact, it is beginning to, on a regional basis, where, well, even internationally, where you've seen currency swap agreements entered into by the Chinese and Iran, Chinese mm-hmm. and Brazil, Chinese and Turkey, Chinese and those in the Pan-Asia region who are interested in doing more and more business with China and want to take the dollar out of the equation.
Do you think that would create a new reserve currency block for the eastern side of the world?
One of the things that Jake suggests is that the IMF and that SDR basket, which we mentioned a couple of times, will likely be more important as time goes on. And as some of these countries who are a small player in the World Bank and the IMF, as they grow in importance and as their vote is more powerful in those international organizations, you will see China's voice and China's currency also become more important. Again, the question of relative size, China is very significant in terms of its population. Mm-hmm. And that's almost where it ends in terms of significance.
Okay, David, let me ask you a question because, again, we're still talking about a communist country. Does cultural liberalization in China ultimately promote political liberalization? I mean,
this
how does
is
that
where
work?
This is where the conflict is ahead in terms of their own national politics. Because you have, with the rise of the Internet, we've seen this with Google and their acceptance, and then they're being shut down, and they're opening up again in China, mainland China. You're seeing people open to Western ideas, a Western lifestyle, and other things that are non-traditional to that particular cultural background. So you're beginning to see some cultural liberalization, and yet there is a lockdown in terms of political control.
They're actually seeing more than the little red book at this point. They're starting to see what's out there.
Right, and this is the beauty of a North Korea. From a North Korean or communist perspective, there is virtually no technological advancement, and they've locked out all foreign media, so they are living in a bygone era.
Right.
I mean, if you went back to the 1940s and 50s, that's where they are in terms of technology. And their belief system, their view of reality, their view of a world and possibilities that it holds for them is very, very shrouded. Whereas China actually has a glimpse into Europe, into America, into the rest of Asia, which has gone through several decades of expansion and growth, including witnessing Japan explode in the post-World War II period as it rebuilt and harnessed a tremendous amount of growth.
Well, I think one of the assumptions that we operate on, and I think it may be an accurate assumption, but it's still worth challenging, is that when a person is open to or has available to them all the information out there, that they prefer freedom and a constitutional type of government. But in reality, not everybody thinks that way. You may have a China that's on the internet, you may have a China that can do their shopping, but a China that still, in some strange way, is a communist or a command economy, where they're told what they can do, what they can buy, where they can go.
Well, and this is where we have a return of history, if you will. Mm-hmm. As Robert Kagan has written about, he highlights the growing conflict between what we've viewed as classical liberalism and autocratic regimes, mm-hmm. where now in the context of a collapse in sort of a capitalist system, and that's how it's being branded,
right,
we're considering other alternatives, and maybe the state really does have the answers. Sarkozy suggested that back in 2009, where he basically said, finally, capitalism is out of the way, and the state can reemerge with great significance.
Well, and you know what's strange is the attitude. The people who do prefer command economies towards an Obama administration, say, versus a Bush administration, it's amazing how they embrace an Obama administration with open arms, because it does seem to tend much more towards command or controlled economy.
And I would tend to agree more with the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek when he said, the more the state plans, the more difficult planning becomes for the individual. Hmm. So still an emphasis on freedom, liberty, autonomy, perhaps less on democracy than just individual freedom, would be my point of contention and my desire, that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and pursue autocracy at the expense of liberalism and individual freedom.
Well, just listening to this conversation, David, and we've had this conversation a number of times, even though it hasn't necessarily been on the air in this program, The question is, I mean, is it a thumbs up on China? Is it a thumbs down? Or is it a discussion that has to continue?
It has to be a discussion that continues because, I mean, what we don't know yet, the verdict is still out. Is this anything different than the periods of glasnost and perestroika that we had under Soviet communism,
right,
wherein you saw an opening of the economy, you maintained a closed political system, but you drew in foreign direct investment, and then shortly thereafter saw a clampdown again on the economy as you went back to a completely controlled versus a semi-open economy?
When in reality, we thought that glasnost, perestroika, many people of this generation still just relate it to Gorbachev, but in reality, it had happened, what, five times? Your dad writes about this often.
Exactly. So we've seen, in the context of 100-year history, we've seen five different periods of Soviet glasnost and perestroika. Mm-hmm. Is this any different? Perhaps it is radically
different.
Maybe it's
an economic glasnost. And maybe it's a, yeah.
And maybe this is the beginning of the end for communism in China. It may be. That's why the conversation has to be an ongoing one, because they have ceded control in some areas, but not in others. The question is, can they maintain control once they've ceded some? And now that we're in an age of technological innovation where information is more universally accessible,
right,
than at any other time in history. And what we saw in Tiananmen Square may have had a very different outcome in 1989. Had hundreds of thousands or millions of people had cell phones on which to communicate, I mean, what does a budding, fledgling revolution look like,
yeah,
when you have that kind of information? We've seen a major crackdown in Iran this last year. Why? Well, the crackdown was necessary because people gathered. How did they gather so quickly? What was their inspiration? Technology was a very key component in the breakdown of the strength and domination of the state. It's one of the reasons why North Korea is so adamant about not importing certain
censorship
technologies.
Yeah, I remember my daughter's reaction when she tried to get on Facebook when we were in a country over in Europe that actually censored out Facebook. It was a completely foreign feeling that she had. She had never been said no to anything on the internet. But, you know, you look in China, and right now, that's still, you're talking about millions of people seeing the Tiananmen Square. That probably would have been censored out at this point. That's where this strange conflict comes from. You've got capitalism, sort of. You've got communism, sort of. And frankly, I don't know that I completely can explain China to somebody if they say, give me a paragraph that would explain China, communism, capitalism, and how it all works.
Well, the closest you're going to get is like standing next to an elephant 6 inches away and explaining what is right in front of you.
Right.
Is it the trunk? Is it the tail? I mean, and you can't possibly understand all of it from that close of perspective, but you do have to get close to understand any of it. So it really is a conversation that needs to be an ongoing one.
Well, and that really is the reason probably to have Martin Jakes on, because he does come from a different point of view, David, than frankly either one of us comes from. I mean, he does have a communist leaning towards his view of China, and actually a view that he believes is an impressive example of how communism can actually succeed and claim victory.
And so many of the variables that we're interested in, if China is going to ultimately be a success story, are hypothetical at this point. I mean, take, for instance, the sovereign wealth funds. They're playing a larger and larger role in the asset diversification, currency reserves, of the currency reserves there in China.
Right.
And in many instances, they're making strategic investments all over the world. What is China's strategy to secure natural resources around the globe?
Well, those are state-owned enterprises at that point, too. A lot of these large resource production units are actually state-owned, and the proceeds go straight into that coffer.
Right, whether it's Sinuk, Sinopec, Chinalco, CNPC, there's so many of them that are making strategic investments all over the world. That's something to watch. What are they doing? What is the significance of the actions they're taking? On the other hand, many have argued that the dollar holdings on the Chinese balance sheet were purchased based on political motives and
right,
not on a financial profit-oriented basis. What political motives might cause the Chinese to liquidate dollars or aggressively diversify into a basket of structures, as we were talking earlier, like the IMF SDRs?
David, let me ask you, I mean, what kind of power do you have politically, like with something like a very, very large hedge fund called, you know, a sovereign wealth fund? At that point, you're talking about being able to control another country's political decisions based on your desire to hold their currency or not.
Sure. Now, our ongoing conversation will include, and I think for those who are interested in this, you should go back and listen to Hernando de Soto's conversations with us, you know, the role of the rule of law, which has not been at the center of Chinese society.
Right.
You know, neither our individual property rights in sort of a textbook communist society. So can their economic growth be internally generated with one or both of those components? Our conversations, as I mentioned with Hernando de Soto, have suggested that these are prerequisites to sustainable economic development. And so again, will that change? Will we see policy implementation? This is what makes it so exciting, is that February of next year, we get the 12th fifth-year plan. And there'll be some speculation as to what is in that plan, but by February of next year, we will know what kinds of reforms they're going to be pursuing aggressively in order to maintain their growth trajectory. And does that include political reform? Does it include an opening of a democratic process? Now, certainly this is where Martin Jakes would say, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, he disagrees with the westernization of China.
They do not
do it their own way.
Exactly. To pursue modernity, they can maintain their power structures. Modernity in the Chinese context does not have to include democracy.
Which
does not.
Opposite from what Stephen Roach was saying. And actually, Stephen Roach is, I believe, part of the policy making at least hint to this new plan.
Well, we know that China has a very unique history and legacy, and it's coupled with their strong views. This is what's very interesting in Jake's book, their strong views of racial superiority.
Right.
And he describes that very well. And what it argues ultimately is that if they do play a large role on the world scene, that their empire will be one of dominion. The reality is any empire to be one of regional or global domination has to be domination. There's that word dominion.
Yeah.
It has to be controlling in some way. Is the U.S. empire any different? No. Was the British empire before it any different? No. We have different kinds of power. As Joseph Nye has argued, some instances it's soft power. In some instances it's hard power. In some instances, it's just firepower.
But a power without the rule of law, David, is a power that is a destructive force to human rights. I mean, you have to say, is economic and political superiority something that is worth the cost of human life?
Well, to the Chinese, it has been, actually.
Yeah.
And Kevin, from 1820 to 1913, GDP per capita was in decline in China. And it remained flat until 1949 and the Communist Revolution. When Mao came into power, it's no surprise that per capita GDP began to increase. It's also no surprise that 40 million people died.
Right.
Per capita GDP is going to increase.
Tens of millions of people dying, that changes the ratio a little bit, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. Well, David, the demographic of China is very different than what we're familiar with here in the West. And you know, maybe you can elaborate on that. I know Martin Jakes does.
Well, one of the most striking characteristics about China is both its geographic size and its demographic footprint in the world scene. Demographics, of course, are never a constant. Current trends in China place the country as the biggest in overall population and potentially one of the worst in terms of rapidly aging populations with a replacement rate that could significantly impair the country's growth. Certainly by 2025, they're going to have a similar problem in terms of an aging population, just like Japan does today.
Right.
Well, will the Chinese alter their one-child policy? Will they create social safety nets in order to accommodate an aging population? This is the conclusion, Kevin. The progress of China is not inevitable. What contingent events can either propel it forward or derail it altogether from someday ruling the world? That's a part of our conversation next week with Martin Jakes.
Well, and I think it's important to realize and just remind our listeners that when we have guests on the show, it doesn't necessarily say that we're endorsing their viewpoint. What we're trying to do is we're trying to mine the field for the jewels or the pearls that may be there, not necessarily the entire mindset.
I learned so much from that book and look forward to the conversation, though there was much in the book that I found disturbing and disagreed with completely.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Join us next week when we interview When China Rules the World author Martin Jakes.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.